From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to this remarkable program we call Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe back with us. She's here every month. Followed by Conversations with Linda. We'll take your calls. Well, first of all, happy birthday to the guy from Pittsburgh, George Senda. What a creative guy he is. Met him at a couple events. He posts a lot of videos on YouTube, and he's very witty. He's got his finger on the pulse of America. He really does. So much so that starting in May, one time a month, he's going to pop on both our website, coasttocoastam.com. You'll see his video, and also on the program where he will give his commentary on events of the day, whether they're paranormal or hard-breaking news stories. But you'll see the guy from Pittsburgh, and you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. But happy birthday, George. Hope you and Kathy have a great one. Here's what's happening. A 25-year-old man who threatened to blow up a Baltimore television station and then was shot and wounded by police did not have a bomb, but a device that was chocolate bars held together by wires. I think he's a little whacked out. The suspect had refused to cooperate with officers, and when he walked out of the building, he was wearing a white panda suit, a surgical mask, and sunglasses before being shot by three officers. They did their job. A bomb robot then scanned the man for nearly an hour before police removed his clothing, picked him up, and carried him into an armed van. Crews transferred him to an ambulance minutes later. He is now in serious but stable condition at a local hospital. The UN says the situation in Syria's city of Aleppo is catastrophic after dozens of people were killed in attacks on targets, including a hospital. Airstrikes on and around the hospital killed at least 27 people, while more than 30 died in other attacks. A UN envoy, Jean England, says the next days could be vital for the humanitarian aid lifeline for much of Syria. It's devastating there. In the past 24 hours, not one, but two North Korean intermediate-range ballistic missiles exploded shortly after launch. It wasn't planned. They failed. But what's that all mean? Jerry Corsi with us, writes for WND.com and noted author. Boy, they're firing off a lot of missiles these days, Jerry.
They are, George, and you know, the fact that they're failing is important, but not nearly as important as the fact that they intend to keep trying. And North Korea has successfully fired shorter-range missiles and missiles from submarines. In fact, they did that also yesterday successfully. So I think it's just a matter of time before North Korea develops a successful long-range missile, and one eventually that will be able to hit the west coast of the United States.
You know, Jerry, you're absolutely right. The submarine launch, which has been our deterrent with Russia for so many years, they've got them, we've got them, and you could hit your continental portion of your country within 5 minutes off the coast. We're concerned about EMPs from North Korea launching a nuke in the atmosphere, detonating it, and shutting down our power grid. If you're doing it from a submarine, if we're not tracking properly, we're going to have no idea where this sub is.
Well, and that's exactly right, George. I mean, you are a Navy veteran. I mean, you understand the power of submarines. And WND was one of the first, with Joseph Farah, I attended years ago, a briefing on EMPs in Washington, a intelligence briefing on them. They're very frightening for their capability to explode a high-altitude nuclear weapon and wipe out the electrical grid, possibly throughout the United States. All computers, all lights going down, all electricity. I mean, it's a nightmare scenario. And one missile fired off of a submarine, just exploded, detonated high-altitude, could accomplish that. Something we're really not prepared for. North Korea already has that capability.
All right, my friend. Thank you. Jerry Corsi. Most people count down the days to retirement, but a recent study has now found out that it could actually send you to an early grave. This is something I have known about all my life. New findings suggest that working past the age of 65 could actually add more years onto your life. It was found to lead to an 11% lower risk of death from all causes. A genetic therapy has improved the vision of patients who would otherwise have gone blind. A clinical study has shown that the improvement is long-lasting and the so-called therapy is suitable to be offered as a treatment. It includes, of course, stem cells. Let's check in with the expert, MyHeartBook.com's Christian Wild. Another amazing form of medical technology, Christian.
It's great news. But this discovery will have much broader application and promise for millions of other people who are suffering from additional retinal diseases, like the 15 million with macular degeneration and 1 in 4,000 who have been blinded with no hope for a cure with retinitis pigmentosa. We've talked about, George, how the world waits for generations until some scientist, some researcher, unlocks the mystery that suddenly makes the impossible in medicine possible. This month, we reported on the exciting cancer breakthroughs at Duke University with gene therapy and how they're using a deactivated polio virus to carry the gene to attack the cancer cell. And in today's study, they're following suit. They're also using a virus to replace the inherited dysfunctional gene. So we'll be hearing more and more about gene therapy. In November of last year in the United Kingdom, a one-year-old girl was fighting for her life with acute lymphoblastic leukemia. And after receiving one session of gene therapy, she was declared free of her disease. Just an idea of what we might have in the future. You know, you and I could be talking to somebody over lunch, and maybe the subject of heart disease comes up. The person says, in my history, in my family, my grandparents, we have never had a problem with heart disease. But we do have an excessive amount of cancer. Well, that's what gene therapy can do. They can go in, find that dysfunctional cancer gene, and neutralize it.
That's amazing.
So it doesn't get passed on, George, to your children and your grandchildren forever and ever. So the history and the magic of cell therapy, along with stem cell therapy, is upon us, and there's going to be great things coming.
Christian's website, by the way, has great information. It's myheartbook.com, but also if you have trouble getting to it like that, use the three W's, www.myheartbook.com. Christian, thanks, and stay in touch with us. The secret to catching a big fish, as they say, is using your friend's ashes as bait. I kid you not. Two British fishermen honored their late friend by using his remains to reel in a 180-pound Siamese carp while on a trip to Thailand. Ron Harper, 64 years old, from a British city, died of cancer before he could go on the trip with his friends. Before Hopper's death, he agreed to let his 65-year-old friends take the ashes to be used in a special bait mix. Using the special purple Ronnie bait, they battled the massive carp for 3 hours before catching and releasing it. This thing is about 4 feet long. It's huge. And the first commercial U.S. test to diagnose Zika virus has won emergency use authorization from the Food and Drug Administration. It's a rare piece of good news as states and the federal government struggle to get out ahead of the Zika virus epidemic as it makes its way north to the United States. But how fast is it coming here? Now, yes, we've had cases, isolated cases, but can it get worse? Up next, we'll spend the hour with Dr. Gary Ridenour on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Gary Ridenour attended Hiram College, then attended medical school in Guadalajara, Mexico, did an internship in Saskatchewan, and then moved to St. Louis for his residency in internal medicine. Gary was one of the main characters in the movie Bad Medicine, also ran his own clinic for the underprivileged, and here he is on Coast to Coast as we talk about so many things, including updating us on the Zika virus. We're going to talk about the situation with the death of Prince. Gary, welcome to the program, first of all, and thanks for making yourself available.
Well, thank you for inviting me again. This is another hot topic that we have to cover.
Oh, sure is. So Zika is making its way north, and our government officials and health officials are concerned, so they've approved a virus test. But how bad is the situation going to get, Gary?
The situation is that there are two mosquitoes in the U.S. related to the Anopheles aegypti, which is down in the tropics, that may be able to carry the virus. And what happens is people will get infected in the subtropical areas, let's say Brazil. They'll fly to the U.S., and for a 10-day period, the virus is in their bloodstream. Mosquito bites them, and then the mosquito picks up the virus.
Okay, now we are convinced, I think you and I are convinced, that this Zika mosquito might have been created in a laboratory. Let's elaborate a little bit on that.
Yeah, it was a number of years ago. They in Brazil, they wanted to get rid of the virus because of dengue fever. And what they did is they mutated the male mosquitoes to be sterile, to release them into the environment, so the females would lay dud eggs. And it went for a year or two. It didn't work. They let all the mosquitoes go, and they took off. And there's a possibility that that may have been the starting point.
All right, so let's talk about the virus, especially what it does. A mosquito, how does the mosquito get it to pass it on?
Well, usually the mosquito picks it up from an infected human. However, new news came out a day ago from, I think, New Guinea, stating that they've now found the Zika virus in monkeys, which is a significant finding because genetically monkeys are closer to us and they have viruses closer to us, and the Zika may recombine itself with other viruses to make it, you know, more fatal. It was found in 1947. It was misdiagnosed and put in the wrong group of a virus family and sat on a shelf there. And it was popping along for a while, but in the last 2 years, it appears that it's mutated, and now the subtropical zones in the world are going to be saturated with this virus.
Jeez, it's kind of scary because we've seen pictures of little babies, and it's not very comforting.
No, the virus gets in, and see, if you're pregnant in the first 3 months or so, the virus will go through the placenta, and it goes down into the pre cells that are going to later develop to be neural cells and bone cells, and mutates them. So you end up with a baby with a small deformed skull and a very small brain, and a lot of them are stillborn.
Okay, so is there anything that we can do to avoid this? I mean, you get bitten by a mosquito. That happens. I mean, we all have been bitten by mosquitoes. What are the odds? If you get bit by one mosquito, what are the odds that it's going to give you Zika?
Well, the odds are most people that get the Zika virus have little viral symptoms and don't feel too well, and it passes. And then in a small percentage of the people, the pregnant females may develop a deformed child. Adults may develop encephalitis or meningitis. Over the age of 55, you may develop something called Guillain-Barré syndrome, in which your arms and legs become totally paralyzed. You're in the hospital for 30 to 45 days to try to get you to walk again and that. And out of that group, 20% of those people will be in a wheelchair for the rest of their lives.
And there's nothing, no cure, nothing?
No, there's nothing right now. The one thing is that the mosquito in Brazil is a daytime mosquito. It's early morning and early evening. And this mosquito has adapted itself to live in urban areas. So if it finds a plastic water bottle that somebody just threw away and it's got a little bit of water in it, it'll go down there and lay its eggs in it.
Oh,
you don't have to go and try to get the ponds and the rivers and stuff. They'll do it in a car tire or anywhere. And that's the big problem, because we've got so much junk all over the planet.
Would you be a little skittish if a vaccine comes out for Zika and you're supposed to give it to your child, the vaccine?
My experience with the last time we had a really good vaccine that came out was in 1982, which was a hepatitis B vaccine. We've been waiting for a vaccine for AIDS for 30 years. The vaccine for Ebola? No. The vaccine for the common flu? 2 years ago, they picked the wrong virus, and so our flu vaccine was only 30% effective.
Jeez.
A lot of companies have been shut down because of poor hygiene and not actually making anything. The problem in the vaccine industry is greed. They want to get money to do their research, and then they make an announcement, their stock goes up, and a few days later they come back and go, this is not going to work.
Yeah, not at all. Okay, last week we lost Prince, 57 years old.
Yep.
The National Enquirer now reporting that he had full-blown AIDS. He took pain pills, and I think those pain pills are what contributed to him dying, of course. But what do we know about this, Gary?
Well, as we know, my God, you look back at the history and see that Rock Hudson died from it.
Yes.
And then on the other end of the spectrum was Liberace.
And then you have someone like Magic Johnson who has been able to fight it.
Yes, he has, and he's spent tons of money for the medications, which is very, very expensive. And when you get the AIDS, you become HIV positive. Coincidentally, I have the longest surviving HIV positive patient in Nevada right now, 14 years. But it is severely depressing, and you can start getting addicted to drugs, and he might have possibly overdosed and committed suicide.
Well, they're not sure he committed suicide, but I guess there are ways that when you give up, you might consider it that.
Well, when you give up and get depressed, your immune system goes down also. And I've seen no pictures of him recently because when...
They said he lost 80 pounds.
All right, well, then bingo, because when you get to the later stages, the weight loss is unbelievable. My patient is doing well because I started this patient on testosterone shots, and that bulked the patient up and kept his weight up, and he's doing fine because of the testosterone.
In addition to other things they're doing?
Yeah, in addition to the other medications, but he went to the HIV clinic, and they went, holy cow, you're looking great. What are you doing? And they said, Dr. Ridner has given me testosterone, and I'm keeping my muscle mass and my hunger, and I'm feeling good.
We're not hearing a lot about HIV like we did 10 years ago. Why not?
It's 30 years old, so it's kind of dropped into the background. It's old news now, and we still got about 43,000 people on the planet that have AIDS right now and are HIV positive, and probably about 23,000 people that have full-blown AIDS. So it's still out there. And as far as getting a vaccine, 30 years of work and no vaccine.
No, nothing at all. And they've spent how much? Billions?
Billions of dollars on this. And it's a tricky virus too, because there's certain antibodies in your system that the AIDS virus will hit. Well, when you give a vaccine, you try to turn on one antibody to kill the virus when it comes in. The problem is the AIDS vaccine may hit a different virus than that, so you can't get to it, and so it's kind of fallen into the background, which is just not acceptable.
All right, Gary, stay with us. We're going to come back in a moment with the time we have left with you. We will take phone calls as we want to talk about the Zika virus and other issues that you have been so, just so important to us. Gary Ridenour with us. We'll take your calls next. Okay, welcome back. We're taking your phone calls for the rest of this half hour with our special guest, Gary Ridenour, the good doctor who's talking with us about Zika, vaccines, other viruses as well. What do you see, Gary, as the biggest health issue facing all of us?
Well, one of the biggest health issues is the Center for Disease Control is in Congress holding their hat out wanting $2 billion to study the Zika virus. Personally, I think one guy could fly down to Brazil with two Ziploc bags, get a bunch of mosquitoes in them, and fly home. They'd have the virus in the mosquitoes, and they could be studied at the CDC. But $2 billion is crazy. It's an election year, and they want to hand this money out to their buddies in the pharmaceutical industry.
Oh, geez. Now, how is Zika getting in? Are the mosquitoes coming into our country? Are they, you know, as they say, it's going north? Or did this get created here because of passengers from planes?
Exactly. They're flying in. We've had three in Reno, Nevada, and they have flown in from contaminated areas, which is only about 40 countries, and have brought the Zika virus in. And new reports are saying that the southeast of the United States is going to be prime territory because of the type of mosquito they got down there. But we still don't know if mosquitoes up north here will be able to carry it or not.
Well, let us hope not. They carry enough, though. What is a mosquito's purpose in life other than for birds to eat them?
Replicate. The female mosquito only bites and gets a blood meal, so she has enough energy and to be able to go and lay her eggs.
The male mosquito does not bite?
To the best of my knowledge, no, he does not. It's the female, and because she needs the blood to lay the eggs.
So what are your recommendations in the summer? You're sitting outside on your patio. What do you do?
Well, the nice thing is down south, the mosquito is a daytime mosquito. He's early morning, early evening. And the good old mosquito bug light is going to be good. And for God's sakes, don't hang it on your porch to attract the mosquitoes to your house. Put it 50 or 60 feet away from your house. Mosquito repellent is good. And long sleeve shirts and... the mosquito range is only 400 yards, so go around 400 yards around your neighborhood and look around and see if there's standing water or other things. And also, the mosquito abatement people have got to get on the wagon real quick and start spraying.
Do those citronella candles work?
Yeah, they do. They'll work. Anything that's smoky will work. As far as putting stuff on your skin, motor oil, mineral oil, any kind of noxious oil-type material on your skin will repel a mosquito.
They love water, too, don't they?
Yes, they do, and they will, you know, it's basically to lay the eggs and move on. So, but like I said, the ones down in subtropics have adjusted themselves to laying eggs in anything that they can find water in.
Does chlorine kill the eggs?
Chlorine will kill the eggs. Back in the old days, you poured motor oil on top of the water, and that was the end of the mosquitoes' larva when they hatched. They got into the motor oil and it killed them. Of course, environmentally, we don't do that anymore.
Okay, let's go to the phones. We'll go to Philip in North Carolina, east of the Rockies, to get things started here. Hi, Philip. Go ahead.
Yes, Doctor. I had a question for you about rheumatoid arthritis. My wife was diagnosed with it a few years ago, and we have probably five other friends that we know have it. And every one of them were diagnosed after having strep. And I was wondering if you had anything to say about that.
Yeah, the strep theory has been out for 10 to 15 years. And the first thing is that most people that get a cold or a sore throat, it's possibly a strep infection. And the bacteria just isn't able to activate your immune system, because what rheumatoid arthritis does is that your immune system looks at your joints and sees them as foreign material and attacks them and causes inflammation. And so the jury's still out on the strep one, but it's a good question.
Lodi, California caller. Hello, Susie. It's your turn.
Hi.
Hello there.
How are y'all?
Good.
I wanted to ask the doctor's opinion. I have psoriatic arthritis and a few other immune issue symptoms, and my doctor would like to do the mesenchymal stem cell treatment for the psoriatic arthritis, and I'd like his opinion on that, and if you think it will help the plaque and the tendon issues that come with the psoriatic arthritis, and also with I have AS, so ankylosing spondylitis, so my spine is really painful. I'd like his opinion on that.
Okay, and you know what? If you have a doctor who's prepared to do stem cells, that's pretty good, Gary, I think.
It is, and it's really tough with rheumatoid arthritis. There's a lot of good, very, very expensive drugs out there, and I see about two out of three of my rheumatoid arthritis patients that the drugs tend to fail. But for the psoriatic arthritis on your skin, there are a lot of different new creams and things to put on them. Sunlight is good for psoriasis also. But current new medication seems to be putting a good dent into this disease. The other thing is with rheumatoid arthritis is keep moving. Don't sit. I mean, if you're watching TV, get a can of beans and start moving your arms around with that can of bean and keep those joints moving, because the last thing you want to do is get those joints locked up.
And once you do, then what?
Then you can actually get calcium deposits into the joint, and the joint will actually freeze itself. So you got to keep moving.
All right, we have Kevin now in Norwich, Connecticut. Hi, Kevin. Thanks for calling. Good morning.
Thank you, George. Pardon me for sounding out of breath. I was just slathering some motor oil all over me. I'm supposed to have sunshine tomorrow.
NW30 is good.
I eat a lot of garlic. I keep hoping that's going to keep the mosquitoes.
There you go. I've been thinking about that, too. hasn't been tested yet, but, you know, the garlic smell may repel mosquitoes. I'm going to start investigating that because that may be an easy possibility for a lot of people. One of the problems in South America is that people can't afford mosquito repellents. So, you know, I've been talking all the time about, you know, using different oils to put on yourself and staying indoors during the time when the mosquitoes are active.
Well, put me on your test list because I love garlic. I'll eat as much of it as you want me to.
Oh, that's great. If I walk by garlic, I have to eat two Tums.
But it's so good.
I can't do it.
It kills vampires.
It does, and it kills my stomach, too.
Gary, you've been into this. You know, you've written a book on pandemics. You're an expert on this. Are you seeing things change over the last few years?
Yes. The change is downhill because of the fact that the world economy is going down. They're removing healthcare workers from the fields, from the field going out and doing things. Living conditions, like you look in Brazil, people are living in these shacks, and there's mud and water in the shacks. And these countries do not have money to aim at improving health care.
No, they don't. They don't. Now, there's some concern about going to Brazil for the Olympics, right?
There is, because of the fact that the Zika virus is very, very heavy in Brazil. And the Brazil government has now started to release the genetically modified mosquito. And the problem is that studies have shown that when you release those males, only about 15% of them survive. So you've got to let a heck of a lot of mosquitoes loose if you're going to keep the females from laying eggs.
Chicago, Illinois caller Sue's with us. Hi, Sue, on our wild card line.
Thank you very much, and God bless you, doctor. I worked at Loyola University when they first had the outbreak of the West Nile virus here. And one of the things that I've noticed is that they don't alert people either. You know, like getting, because people forget. And they become very ambivalent. And a lot of little children are roaming around with shorts on and short tops and everything. And people just don't keep up with what's going on.
You know, exactly. I was going to mention this, that in the last 3 days, I've talked to my patients, and 7 out of 10 of my patients did not know what the Zika virus was. I mean, it's, you know, you pick up the paper, and all you see is Trump and Clinton. I suggest the best place to keep up on things is go to CIDRAP, C-I-D-R-A-P, the University of Minnesota. They are not politically connected, and they've got the straight poop on everything that's going on.
Truly amazing what's going on this entire planet.
Oh.
Now we're not hearing too much about Ebola anymore. Now what happens?
Well, Ebola's coming back again. And, you know, we kind of didn't do anything, and 15,000 people died. And then there was, quote, an Ebola vaccine, and that ended up being a farce. And there are reports that the Ebola is starting to come back again.
Jeez.
And we're not doing anything.
We have Ted in Olympia, Washington, now west of the Rockies. Ted, go ahead.
Hello, George. Hello, Doctor.
Hey,
great
Ted.
Show tonight.
Thank you, sir,
for having this on. Just a real quick question. I have my own radio show in Seattle called Out of This World Radio, and I had a program on Zika virus about a month ago. And in that program, the guest that I had was a guy named Francis Boyle from the University of Illinois Law School. He said that the Zika virus was patented by the Rockefeller Foundation in 1947, and this current outbreak of Zika virus was actually funded and propagated by Bill Gates as a way of population control.
Well, that's a great conspiracy theory. And it's going to have to stand for a while because, quite frankly, they haven't really even gotten into looking at the genetic makeup of the virus to see whether or not it may have been manipulated or not. So it's going to take a while. Bill Gates ran a big program for polio, from what I understand, in India, and he got the wrong vaccine from the wrong company, and according to the stories, he gave 43,000 people polio.
Jeez. You know, he's pro-vaccine. I don't think he is out to kill people by any means.
No. Well, in the original vaccine, the Salk vaccine, was fantastic, and then we went to the Sabin, and then years later they went back and found out that the Salk vaccine was contaminated with a monkey virus that if we continued to use it, by the time you got to 50, you would develop neurological problems.
We've got Joseph in New Orleans. It's your turn, Joseph, first-time caller. Go ahead.
Hi, Mr. Noy.
Hi, Joseph.
How are you doing? I'm just calling to you discussed something about the HIV virus.
Yeah.
And I don't want people to get discouraged because I've been HIV positive for 32 years.
32 years?
Yeah. And I haven't had a single medical issue except getting old.
Joseph, what are you doing to control it or to keep it in check?
I take medication.
What kind? Can you tell us the kind?
Yeah, I take 3 different kinds. I take Reataz, Zeret, and Epivir.
Is it like a cocktail?
Yeah.
And that's one, and God bless you for making it this long, man. The idea of our medication right now is to prevent the replication of the virus so you won't go in and have AIDS. The other thing, too, is that there's multiple forms of the AIDS virus. So just like hepatitis B, there's five kinds of hepatitis C. So you may have been lucky enough to have gotten a non-virulent form of the virus.
Now, is this something that could be eradicated, or is it going to be with us until the end of time, Gary?
The way it looks like, it's going to be around for a long time because it's just a virus that you just can't get an angle on. So, we just have to go with safe sex and more education, which, by the way, has just practically dropped out of the school systems in the United States. They don't even know about AIDS and HIV anymore.
Let's go to Pete in New York City. Hi, Peter. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to say about the mosquitoes, two things, actually.
Sure.
I used to have a couple of girlfriends many years ago, and we'd hang out outside during sunsets and such and camping, and they were never touched by mosquitoes. Everybody else was being eaten alive. And what their secret was eat a lot of fruit and the B vitamins, and they were never touched.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah, B6 vitamin has been a favorite for repelling mosquitoes, and I haven't caught up on it lately, but I'm going to do that. The other thing is that mosquitoes are attracted by carbon dioxide coming out of you, and they smell the carbon dioxide and head towards you because they realize that there's something living there. And some people don't put up enough carbon dioxide. Sometimes the smells off their skin won't attract the mosquito. I'm one of the guys, like you, that I can sit outside and everybody's eaten alive and they're not touching.
They don't touch you at all.
And I have no idea why.
Huh. Okay, Pete, you had another question?
Well, yeah, I was wondering about you, George. I've been on, you keep saying about pain meds, and I've been on it for 20 years, and this is getting to be a joke and ridiculous. People are dying because they can't get their pain meds, you know. And, you know, these alternative things, they don't work. For 20 years, I've bought everything, tried everything. It doesn't work.
Well, I'll tell you, I'm one of four or five doctors in this state that signs the paperwork for medical marijuana cards. And there are various concoctions of medical marijuana that are good for pain control. And our state, it looks like, is going to go and make it completely legal in November. But I would look into that because they're starting to break down the chemicals, all the chemicals in the marijuana, and they've made salves out of it and other things. And there's one recipe I give my patients, and half a cc on their tongue, and about 45 minutes later, they're not really loaded from the marijuana, but their pain level has dropped down.
And that's the important thing. Gary, thanks for being on the program.
You're
Let's
welcome,
keep
sir.
In touch, my friend. Dr. Gary Ridenour. Up next, investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe joins us. She's got a series of incredible stories that she'll talk with us about. Then in our last hour, it's always called Conversations with Linda, where we take your calls. And welcome back to Coast. Tonight, investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe joins us, followed at our last hour with Conversations with Linda. You know, oysters in the northwestern part of the United States are dying at an alarming rate. Why? That's one of the stories Linda will tackle for us when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Linda Moulton Howe with us. We've got lots to cover with Linda, so we'll get right into it. Linda, first of all, welcome back, and my gosh, there's so much going on.
Oh, I know. Every 24 cycle, it's like 100 times what it was last year. And on April 22nd, 2016, something happened that's never been seen before. It was Earth Day, and never have so many countries signed an agreement at once as 175 did on opening day to sign the Paris Agreement to fight what is now seemingly a relentless rise in global air and ocean temperatures. even North Korea signed. The nations that did not sign the agreement on April 22nd have a year to do so. China, it's the world's top carbon dioxide emitter, announced its intentions to, quote, finalize domestic procedures, close quote, to ratify the Paris Agreement before the gathering of the G20 summit in China 5 months from now in September. The second largest CO2 emitter, the United States, represented by Secretary of State John Kerry, pledged to ratify the Paris Agreement this year, and so did the 28-nation European Union, along with Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and leaders of Mexico and Australia. As CO2 continues to increase from a variety of sources, temperature data around the world through 2015 showed that the average global temperature on Earth has climbed at least 1.02 degrees Celsius, which is halfway to the dangerous threshold of a 2 degrees Celsius increase that, if reached this century, scientists say could mean ice melting faster in Arctic, Greenland, and Antarctica, and that would mean faster rising sea levels and threats to many life forms from the oceans to islands to land. And warming ocean waters are killing corals. The UK's Guardian headlined on April 16th, "I was shocked. Most of the coral in the Great Barrier Reef is dead or dying." That was writer James Woodford, who does science reporting from the field for The Guardian. He described his firsthand trip along the Great Barrier Reef, and he wrote, quote, "What I was seeing beneath me was evidence of an environmental disaster that has been unfolding over the past few months. The largest mass coral bleaching event ever recorded in this region," close quote. In April, the UK's National Coral Bleaching Task Force reported that 95% of the Great Barrier Reef is now severely bleached and should be placed on the endangered species list. Without the massive coral reefs, an untold number of other marine life will have to move somewhere else or they will perish. Not only is CO2 in the atmosphere causing a global warming problem, but the gas has been absorbed by the Earth's oceans in great quantities the past few decades. And without that enormous absorption, the Earth would be even warmer. But all that CO2 absorption in the waters is changing ocean chemistry that can kill marine creatures such as oysters. On April 4th, 2016, Oregon State University News headlined that, quote, "The ocean chemistry along the west coast of North America is changing rapidly because of global carbon dioxide emissions, and the oyster industry is confronted with high mortality rates of juvenile oysters because of increasingly acidified water." One man who has devoted his life and career to understanding and protecting marine organisms is Stephen Palumbi, PhD and professor of biology, director of the Hopkins Marine Station at Stanford University in Monterey, California. Recently, in an Earth Files interview, he explained why oysters and the Great Barrier Reef are having such a hard time staying alive. Here now from Stanford University is Professor Stephen Palumbi.
The little tiny larvae that make the oyster farms run and be profitable and productive have to make little tiny shells, and if the water is too acidified, then those tiny oyster larvae can't make their shells. They die. Farms then can't do the aquaculture that a lot of oyster lovers all over the country depend on.
From your point of view right now, as we speak in April 2016, how serious is this threat to the oyster supply on the Pacific coast?
That threat is pretty severe. There are these two reasons why the ocean is becoming more acidified. One is the global presence of CO2 in the atmosphere. But there are local CO2s in coastal areas because microbes are out of balance in coastal water because of eutrophication or pollution or other, like sedimentation and runoff. over the last couple of years, we've discovered that too much CO2 in the water is this huge, invisible coastal water pollutant that we didn't know existed. And that coastal water pollutant is what the oyster farms are actually encountering. They had no idea what was killing the larvae or what was destroying their business, but there's this global problem as well.
Is it possible that within the next 25 years that the seafood world would be dead or dying or incapable of meeting demands of voracious humans who like seafood? The decline could finally convince China and some of the other countries that they are not going to be able to live as normal unless they stop what they're doing with coal and other CO2 and methane producing industries.
I think the seafood decline will play a role, but one of the additional problems then is that as wild seafood declines in abundance for the reasons that you said, that people turn more and more to aquaculture. Aquaculture can be done really well, but it can also be done in a very damaging way. And the more that countries use damaging aquaculture to grow food, then the further back we're pushed.
That leads to The Guardian on April 16th, quote, "I was shocked. Most of the coral in the Great Barrier Reef is dead or dying." And this is an article by James Woodford, who is a science reporter for The Guardian. It seems like it is part of this great issue of what is happening to the oceans chemically that is causing death and so many problems worldwide.
I think you're exactly right that there's a huge link here. The link is because of what CO2 actually does in the ocean and in the atmosphere. So acidification is what happens when CO2 goes into the ocean. Like we were just talking about, oysters are a big problem. For corals, this event is the biggest, most dramatic bleaching event that's ever been seen on the Great Barrier Reef, particularly the northern Great Barrier Reef. Reefs all over the world provide a lot of seafood because fish live on coral reefs, but they are also living seawalls. They capture a lot of the wave energy that hits them and protects the shoreline behind them. So imagine if you were living along the east coast of the United States or on the Atlantic coast of Europe, and all of a sudden 95% of the seawalls on that entire coast crumbled into dust. That is what just happened on the Great Barrier Reef. The reason why they make reefs is because they secrete skeletons. The skeletons are made of calcium carbonate. They're one of the kinds of organisms which, as the CO2 level goes up, they have a harder and harder time in making those skeletons. Right now, most of the CO2 levels that corals are facing are not as debilitating as what the oysters are facing. But the corals in the Great Barrier Reef are actually experiencing the other CO2 problem, and that's ocean warming. So CO2 in the atmosphere creates a blanket that holds in heat, and as a consequence, ocean temperatures have been going up all over the world. We think of corals as being tropical, and they are, and they must love hot water, and they do, but they're kind of wimpy in that if the water goes a degree or two above what their physiology would normally limit them to, they undergo this phenomenon of bleaching. They spit out their internal symbionts that are colored. They turn white, and they no longer have a food supply, and so 50 to 80% of them die. What that says is that even when you are managing things as well as possible, you're still subject to these problems of ocean warming. The Great Barrier Reef is under these sort of stresses. Think about all of the reefs in the Caribbean that are less well managed, all the reefs around the Pacific that are less well managed. They're likely to be equally or worse off. So the service that that reef provides just in capturing waves and protecting communities against storm damage is an incalculable kind of value that is being lost. In the United States, Hurricane Sandy hit New York and woke everybody up to the idea that wave surges and storms when the sea level is going up actually is a big problem. So sea levels are going up, storms are increasing, and at the same time, the ability of living marine creatures to make living seawalls, to make barriers that protect communities against storm surge, is also declining.
What do you think would be the best way to sequester CO2 from getting into the ocean waters?
Right now, the only way that I can imagine sequestering CO2 is actually by not putting it in the atmosphere at all. That switching to renewable sources of energy, solar power, wind power, hydropower, are the ways of reducing that CO2 emission. But we're not talking about magic here. We are talking about technology that allows us to capture energy for free from the sun and from tides and from water and from wind, putting those into grids that allow people to live normal, high-energy lives, but without this creeping, corrosive addition of CO2 into our planet's lungs and our planet's bloodstream.
What do you say to people who argue, well, there was a time of dinosaurs on the planet when there was no ice at the Antarctic or the Arctic, and they lasted for 80-some million years. So what is the big deal now?
Well, dinosaurs didn't own condos in Miami. and you know, if it was just dinosaurs, it wouldn't be a problem. But it's not about dinosaurs, and it's not even about, you know, the life of the oceans. It's about people. And a good fraction of our species lives on coastlines in very complicated cities that will not be able to function if sea level goes up too much and storms wash the ocean into those cities. It's not just Bangladesh. It's not just places that are developing countries, but we have communities around the United States that are seriously affected now by rising tides and are going to be inundated. There was an amazing paper that came out about a month or so ago about king tides. King tide is when strong tides lead to coastal flooding of communities, roads, people's houses, bridges, everything. Surveyors asked people, 30 years ago, did you ever hear of king tides? Was there ever any flooding? People say, oh, every once in a while something would happen, but no, it wasn't very common, and now it happens all the time.
Right.
So this change in what we call king tides is a real harbinger of the kinds of changes that will be affecting us. And it's not that we're worried about the coastal ecosystems in king tides. It's our own infrastructure that we have to worry about in our society. So when people say, well, the planet will deal with it, I totally agree. The planet will deal with it. In a million years, the planet won't even know that we did this to it. But we're really worried about the next 100 years and maybe the next 200 years where our kids and grandchildren and our legacy really is under threat. That's what it's about. It's about people.
What do you think, realistically, is the worst case on the current timeline of 2016 going forward? When might we be in such a turbulent world that everything you just stated will be putting every human and every creature on the planet under stress simply to survive?
I think that that's absolutely true. It increases the stress on all marine life because the water's too warm. For people, there's less food. There's more need to repair coastal infrastructure, cities and roads and ports. All of that is more and more and more energy fighting this process that we've got. But we still are in a period of time where we can make a choice. If we look at business as usual scenarios where we're just going to pump CO2 into the atmosphere at the rate we're doing right now, then in 85 years, by the year 2100, all the predictions are that catastrophic changes will happen around the planet and the ocean that really change how we actually can use the ocean, whether it's for seafood or for coastal protection or whatever. Acidification by that point will be so global that the sort of problems that Oregon oystermen were seeing just locally will be global, worldwide, over all the oceans if business as usual keeps going. But things are beginning to change. And we know that if we begin to slow down putting in CO2 in the atmosphere, and we essentially stop putting CO2 in the atmosphere, say in the next 35 years, by 2050, if we were to do that, then the world would begin to shake off the CO2 addiction, the CO2 would become scrubbed out of the atmosphere, and then by 2100, things will begin to be getting better. So the kind of disastrous circumstances that you were describing are absolutely on track right now, but we still can choose. We're still in a decade of choice.
And, George, if you go to my earthfiles.com report about the whole global warming impact and absorption of CO2 in the oceans and the air, there is an extraordinary graph from the Hadley Center, the UK Met Office, that shows from 1850 to 2015 and climbing how persistent and just never letting up, really, this global pattern of warming has been. And the it was in Science, April 8th, the journal Science, this amazing headline: global warming is changing the way the Earth spins on its axis. And this is from a very interesting paper that talks about how global warming is shifting the way our Earth wobbles on its polar axis. And this is from data from NASA. And it comes back to melting ice sheets, especially those in the Northern Hemisphere in Greenland. They're changing the distribution of weight on the Earth. Greenland is melting much, much faster than anybody had expected by now. And that has caused both the North Pole and this wobble, which is called polar motion, to change sort of their course. And that is from the melting ice. And some of the scientists said this recent shift from the 20th century direction is really dramatic and highlights how real and profoundly large this global warming, whether from humans, we're coming out of an ice age, all the combinations, it's having a big effect on the planet. Since 2003, Greenland alone has lost, on average, more than 600 trillion pounds of ice a year. That's why where this wobble is changing. And one of the scientists who was a co-author on this study that was published in Science, Eric Ivan, said that he likes to think, quote, of it as a billion trucks each year dumping ice out of Greenland. And on top of that, West Antarctica loses 275 trillion pounds of ice, and East Antarctica gains about 165 trillion pounds of ice yearly. And that is affecting the wobble, and the reason for those changes in loss and gain in West Antarctica and East Antarctica has to do with the changing wind patterns. The wind patterns have changed because of global warming, and so there can be ice deposit in one area and tremendous loss in another, all consistent with what is happening in global warming.
That's a great story, Linda. We're going to come back and talk about reincarnation and past lives. Okay, welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, along with Linda Moulton Howe, and we're going to talk about past lives in this segment. This has got to be fascinating for even you, Linda, right?
Oh, it really, truly is. I think it's one of the most important subjects that all of us should try to study. And it was back in November of 1984 that I was a speaker at the University of Nebraska with astronomer and Center for UFO Studies founder J. Allen Hynek, Ph.D. And at that conference, I presented my investigations of bloodless, trackless animal mutilations around the world. And Dr. Hynek talked about his 1960s investigations of UFOs and his work as a scientific advisor for the U.S. Air Force and Project Blue Book. And Allen would later criticize that Project Blue Book as deliberately deceiving the public and media about an alien presence. He eventually concluded that the public Project Blue Book was a government PR effort to deflect attention from unidentified aerial phenomena that authorities secretly behind the scenes referred to as advanced extraterrestrial biological entities and sometimes other dimensionals and other times time travelers. We talked about all of that. And after our respective talks to the conference, Dr. Hynek said to me, Linda, let's let our hair down with each other. And I thought, wow, I'm going to learn what Hynek really knows about UFOs and ETs.
Plus, he was almost bald. He didn't have any hair.
Well, that's true. We went to a quiet room away from the conference buzz, and to my surprise, Dr. Hynek began with, "Linda, the most important book I've ever read, and hope you will read too for more understanding about the complexities of this phenomena, is a book, Theosophy, by Rudolf Steiner."
Huh.
Now, neither Hynek nor I knew that he would pass into another dimension only a year and a half later from a brain tumor.
Yes.
And I would not learn from abductees about alleged ET soul transfer technology, or as some call it, resurrection technology, for seven more years in 1991. And that was when abductee Linda Porter sent me illustrations after she had seen human soul life force radiating as a gold-orange light moving from a dying man's body into a younger cloned version of that man. And that clone was preserved in a lighted tube under the supervision of a praying mantis and gray Eben-type ETs. And all of the Linda Porter case with her color illustrations, which are so fine, are in my third book, Glimpses of Other Realities, Volume 2, High Strangeness. It's always in my Earthfile shop. Well, from that to Rudolf Steiner's book, it is about reincarnation as the machinery of the universe. And he called flaming souls that are the vital link between matter that dies and the spirit dimension that is eternal and gains knowledge through eternity by moving in and out of all kinds of body containers in the matter worlds. Perhaps human souls have the potential to be stronger and freer than whatever life force is in the aliens that depend upon cloning and hybridization to survive. I wish he were here to have that discussion. And yet reincarnation is as controversial as UFOs in terms of being real or not. In the past few months, there have been various scientific articles about using DNA to store massive quantities of digital data. That idea provoked for me the question, could DNA memory storage explain children who vividly, in great detail, remember previous lives? I took that question to Jim Tucker, MD, Associate Professor of Psychiatry and Neurobehavioral Sciences at the University of Virginia, and here he is now from Charlottesville.
Most of the cases involve a child who reports memories of a past life of somebody who they are not related to. For memories to be passed down through the genes, the child would have to be a direct descendant of the previous person. And also, three-quarters of our kids talk about how they died in the previous life, and obviously genes get passed on before someone is at their death scene. So there's no way those memories could be transferred through their genes. One well-known example here in the U.S., and we've studied 2,500 cases from around the world, but one of the well-known ones in the U.S. is a little boy named James Leininger, who had memories of being a World War II pilot. It's believed that pilot has now been identified. James is born from this Christian couple in Louisiana. His dad in particular is quite opposed to the idea of past lives. But around the time of James's second birthday, he started having horrific nightmares multiple times a week where he'd be kicking his legs up in the air, screaming, "Airplane crash on fire, little man can't get out." And also during the day, he would repeatedly take his toy airplanes and say, "Airplane crash on fire," and slam it into the family's coffee table. So sometime after his second birthday, his parents were also able to talk with him while he was awake about these memories. And he said how he had been a pilot and that his plane had crashed on fire, that he had been shot down by the Japanese. And he said that he flew a Corsair, now this is a two-year-old, flew a Corsair, which is a type of plane that I'd never heard of, but one that was developed during World War II. And then he said he flew off of a boat, and his parents asked him the name of the boat, and he said Natoma. And his dad then found there had been USS Natoma Bay that was stationed in the Pacific during World War II. He printed out the information, which the printout shows the date he printed it out. So documents when James was 28 months old, the word Natoma was part of the story. They also asked him who he had been, and he would always say, me or James. They also asked him one time who else was there, and he said, Jack Larson. He later said that he had been shot down at Iwo Jima, and it turned out that the USS Natoma Bay did, in fact, take part in the Iwo Jima operation. There was only one pilot from the ship that was killed during that operation, which was a 21-year-old young man from Pennsylvania named James Houston. So if James Leininger was remembering a past life, it had to be Houston's life because he was the only pilot on the Natoma Bay who was killed at Iwo Jima. Well, it turns out that Houston, in fact, had flown a Corsair. His plane crashed exactly as James described. He said how his plane was hit in the engine, it burst into flames, crashed in the water, and quickly sank, which is exactly what Houston's plane did. And James had said how Jack Larson was there with him, and Jack Larson was the pilot of the plane next to Houston on the day that he was killed.
Hmm.
So this is a case where the father did the research on this, but we've got very good documentation that was made before he was able to identify Houston as a pilot. And details from little James match perfectly with this World War II pilot who had been killed 60 years before he was born. Houston and his family had absolutely no connection to James's family, and it seems impossible that he could have learned that information through any sort of normal means.
Does that mean that there is a soul spirit memory that absorbs lifetimes and can recycle in a reincarnative cycle, and that humans would remember past lives?
Well, we really can only speculate about exactly what this means. In the narrowest terms, it provides good evidence that some children have memories of a life from the past. So the most obvious explanation is that they're remembering a past life because they experienced that past life, which would imply some kind of continuation. We would certainly be tempted to say a spirit or a soul. I suspect it's probably more complex than we can really understand, but it would be something like that. But there are other explanations possible. One idea that some people have proposed is that the child is connecting with this data bank of memories, but not that the child actually experienced those things himself, even though the child thinks that he did because he has these quote-unquote memories, but that he didn't really have that life. There are other speculative ways of looking at these cases that they don't really prove what the process is, but I do think they provide strong evidence that there can be this connection between lives of an individual continuing from one life to another.
What about the possibility that DNA itself is some kind of a medium in which entire life experiences can be encoded in ways that maybe we haven't understood and so far don't have a way to extract, but the DNA itself can record?
Well, it's certainly an interesting thing to speculate. But our cases would not be consistent with that explanation because the children are not descendants of the previous person or even descendants of anyone who was present when these things were happening. As far as whether genes can carry memories, if it does, for the most part, it has to be on some sort of unconscious kind of level because, as far as we know, most children don't come out reporting memories of their grandparents or their great-grandparents.
Well, let's go back to the idea of the body container in which there is an animating spirit soul. It seems that the work you are doing with children, it links to the out-of-body experiences of people who have been near death. There's a part of them that seems to leave the body container and have extraordinary experiences in some other dimension. And then they come back to describe. So again, it seems this is all reinforcing the concept that there is some sort of a soul spirit that is going in and out of body containers, has some sort of a matrix of its own that can record life experiences and retell them.
Well, that's right. We use slightly different terminology, but yes, there's this idea that consciousness can exist separate from a functioning brain. So in our cases of the children, it appears that this consciousness has continued after someone died, and it somehow becomes associated with a new developing brain and shows up as past life memories. In the case of near-death experiences, yes, people can describe incredible experiences that happens in another realm like heaven. Some of them have also given details of things that happened around them as they were physically at the point of death, as their heart had stopped and the code was underway to try to bring them back. And occasionally they will describe events that happened down the hall or even in another location that proves to be accurate for what was going on. So yes, it does suggest that there was this consciousness that was capable of experiencing new knowledge, of taking in new information while the brain was not functioning.
Is there any reason why we as a human family should not then embrace the concept of a soul spirit as a third part of mind, body, and spirit?
Well, soul and spirit have connotations that are not necessarily supported by this work. The work that we do is not from a religious perspective, but the work does suggest that, as you say, that there's this consciousness piece that can be considered separate from the body and the functioning brain. Beyond that, I think in the bigger picture, I would argue that the physical world, that it actually grows out of consciousness. That, as Max Planck, who was the founder of quantum theory, as he said, he viewed consciousness as fundamental. He thought matter was derived from it. I think there's a lot of truth in that, and would mean that we would have no reason to think that consciousness would end when a physical brain dies, but the whole physical world grows out of consciousness, and these pieces of consciousness get attached to the brain but are not necessarily dependent on it.
Well, is there any reason why the soul-spirit concept shouldn't be part of the physics of body, mind, soul, spirit? What is wrong with that?
Well, the main objection, I would say the main mainstream objection, is that everything grows out of the physical. So there is this physical world, and animals develop through evolution, and the brain developing consciousness is just sort of a byproduct that happened to occur through certain evolutionary advantages. I think if we're going to use terms like soul and spirit, then we better define them rather carefully. For me, it's enough to just consider there is this consciousness or mind, or if you prefer, spirit piece, that is a separate entity from the physical world. And I would say there is good evidence that it can exist after the physical body that it's attached to dies.
Do you suppose the implication is that there is a certain amount of time that a given soul spirit is supposed to be in a given body container, and if that is cut short for reasons, as you said, murder or something else that's not a natural death, that the time inside of a container is important some way, and that could explain why there are some recyclings?
Well, some people have talked about the idea of unfinished business, but it does seem either dying violently or actually dying young. There may well be something to this idea that a life that is cut short that leads the consciousness to continue on in a life here as if the last one didn't fulfill its complete purpose.
It gives hope beyond a planet that seems sometimes to be sinking into nothing but violence.
Exactly.
That's a great report, Linda.
Well, thank you. And coming back full circle to the book that J. Allen Hynek recommended to me, Theosophy by Rudolf Steiner, there is a section of that book entitled The Spirit in Spirit Land After Death. And these words I'm going to share now were written by Rudolf Steiner in 1922. Quote, "In each life, the human spirit appears as a repetition of itself with the fruits of its former experiences in previous lives. No two human beings have the same spiritual form. When the human spirit has passed through the world of souls on its way between two incarnations, it enters the land of spirits to remain there until it is ripe for a new bodily existence. Only by being embodied, incarnated, can man work in the world of bodies. He must take on the physical body as his tool so that through the body he can act on other bodies and they on him. What acts through this physical corporeality of man is the spirit. From this spirit flow the purposes, the direction its work is to take in the physical world. After its birth in the physical body, the soul, when met by some hard fate, has no glimmering of the fact that in the purely spiritual life before birth, the impulse that led to this hard fate had been voluntarily accepted by that soul. What therefore seems completely unwished for from the point of view of the earth life is willed by the soul itself in the supersensible, close quote. And in this conversation that Dr. J. Allen Hynek and I had back in 1984, what I had not experienced at that point were the people in the abduction syndrome who would come to me in 1991, half a dozen of them, and that they would had had experiences with something in the alien presence in which there were these resurrection technologies. And the bottom line that I was left with from them, because that is what was communicated, is that the universe, the cosmos, whatever big word you want to use, is multidimensional, and the key to everything is the recycling of the soul in and out of containers. Even if we don't have minds and consciousness large enough to understand it, that is the key.
That is the key indeed. And Linda, more great stories just ahead on Coast to Coast AM, including an Egyptian Sphinx-looking object. Is there a Sphinx out there near Alaska? Linda went out to check. Remember that story, because she talked a little bit about that before on Coast to Coast and earthfiles.com, and she'll be back with us in a moment to talk about this on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Linda, update us on this story out there in Alaska.
Yeah. Well, on April 10th of this year, I received a series of emails with image attachments from a 33-year-old man named Jared Beeler. He lives in Priest River, Idaho, where he is an airplane assembler for Quest Aerospace. And what provoked him to email me was his learning about my 2012 Earth Files reports about the alleged dark pyramid underground that you've heard me talk about quite a bit on Coast, and I've reported almost a dozen times at Earth Files, and have been hoping that more whistleblowers would come forward on that dark pyramid that is supposed to be about 60 miles straight west of Mount Denali, that was formerly known as Mount McKinley. And in his this new person, Jared Beeler, his first email, he said, quote, "I have a similar story, but it's about a Sphinx, like in Giza, that was up there," meaning in the Alaska range of mountains and glaciers. He said, quote, "I heard about it while I was training in Black Rapids between Anchorage and Fairbanks," close quote. And the next day, on April 11th, Jared sent me a second email with more information, quote, "I was in the Army at the time from Fort Richardson, and it was in 2005. I was sent up north to a mountaineering training camp for the Army, and the place was called Black Rapids. Just like the Dark Pyramid, the group around this Sphinx was heavily armed, and they were doing some sort of investigation on it. And from what the sergeant told me, he didn't know who they were, but they were not regular Army," close quote. And what he's referring to is, in the Dark Pyramid story, there was one helicopter pilot who took in the father of the man talking to me as a whistleblower, and that at the site where they were delivering something, and the pilot knew that it was a very ancient, huge underground pyramid, there were all kinds of military jeeps, all kinds of heavy-duty armament at this site. And so that's why he's saying he has been told the same thing about the Sphinx in the work that he was doing for the Army. Well, now, a week later, Jared sent another email with some satellite images of Alaska's Kastner Glacier, in which he circled where the Black Rapids Army Northern Training Facility is near the unnamed glacier that they trained on, and it parallels Kastner Glacier, where allegedly a large sphinx like the one at Giza in Egypt was seen and photographed in 2004 or 2003 by an Army Sergeant Borellis, exact spelling and first name unknown. You can see all of these Google Earth and maps at myearthfiles.com website. This is a fascinating report in which, in looking at where he has circled what he remembered from where he was, takes us into an intriguing shot that I have gotten from Google Earth, where I place, with his help, the alleged location of the Sphinx you're going to hear about, and where I have done all of that investigation of the alleged dark pyramid. They're about 120 miles apart on a ridge, clear ridge, that is has both glaciers and open ground. Well, Sergeant Borellis, that he mentioned, was in charge of a mountaineering training group that included Jared Beeler and half a dozen other men in July 2005. And that's when Jared told everyone about a UFO he and his buddies saw when they were 16 years old in Salmon, Idaho. And after that UFO story, Sergeant Borellis told Jared and the group about the discovery of a large sphinx about 4 days' hike up Kastner Glacier from Black Rapids. Now, for some background, before the sphinx story, Jared and his family had seen a large multicolored flying disc near their Salmon, Idaho home, first in 1997 when Jared was 14, and then 2 years later in the winter of 1999, he was with his friend Chris around midnight when another UFO showed up and led them to one of the most frightening moments of their young lives. That is the story that Jared told Sergeant Borellis and his Army group when they were at Black Rapids for the glacier training hike next to Kastner Glacier. And here he is now from Priest River, Idaho, to tell us.
Me and my friend Chris, we're in Salmon, Idaho, and we wanted to get together and see if we could see a UFO. Salmon, Idaho seems to be a hot zone for UFO activity. It's not the first time that I'd seen one there. My family had seen them. One flew over our house one time, very close, kind of hovered there before it took off. This time, I'd say it's about 12 o'clock at night. And all of a sudden, out across the field, up over the Book Cliffs, Salmon River is, south of town, below all the big mountains, kind of in the foothills right there, which there's no roads out in there. And we see a UFO cruising along, maybe about 100, 200 miles an hour, cruising pretty fast. I'd say it was about 20, 30 feet off the ground, pretty good size, and was all lit up. Lights around it, not on top or bottom, around in a circular shape. I counted maybe 5 or 6 evenly spaced lights around it. I don't think there was any color to the lights. They were white.
Pulsing in any rhythm?
No, they were steady from what I could see.
How are you seeing the shape, and what is the shape?
I'm seeing the shape from the lights themselves that they're making around it. I can tell that it goes around in a circle.
How many feet do you think the truck is from the object?
I'd say it's a mile by air.
At a mile, knowing that it's circular, how big do you think this object is?
A couple row widths, maybe 3 in width sideways. So anywhere for about 75, maybe 90 feet in diameter. It's flying along and it's going really fast, about 20, 30 feet or so off the ground. Instantly, me and him both knew exactly what it was. It was a flying saucer.
You are now watching it move low to the ground for about how many seconds?
5 to 8 seconds.
And then what happened?
And then we're expecting it to keep going out to the right, but it went behind something up there and it never came out. We're looking at each other and we're both like, are you kidding me? I can't believe we're seeing this. We got to get up there now. So I fly out of there. I'm like, I remember a road that kind of cuts out and then goes back south. I bet that heads right out to where we saw that UFO stop. And I'm like, oh, wow, there it is. And the head slam on the brakes. Here's that road right here that I was talking about. And it starts to turn and go out south. But we're now up in the foothills. There's no main road. Well, about that time, I look down at my window down the ground, and I've seen some really funny-looking footprints. Three, kind of like two in the front, round circles, and one behind it.
The prints that you're seeing look like circles, like you would do a cookie cutter, two in the front and one in the back?
Exactly, yes, but nothing too big.
But no toes, just circles?
Yeah, exactly, yes.
How far down in the snow did they go?
Kind of right there on the surface of the snow.
1 inch?
Yeah, maybe an inch. It wasn't very deep. We're right in the area now where we saw that UFO stop. And I start to drive down the road, click on my brights, and the second I click on my brights, there's something standing right outside the edge of my light, and I slam on the brakes. At the time, I don't know what it is. It's got huge black eyes, diagonal. It looks like an alien. I'm freaking out. I have this, like, fear or whatever that's going to run really fast, jump on the hood. I'm not looking. I'm covering my face. I'm hitting the locks on the door. I start flying out of there. I've never been so scared in my life. I'm terrified. It was all I see at the time is these eyes. We make it back. We go to my house. We're both breathing heavily and freaking out. While we're at the house, we both start talking like, what did we see? What could that have possibly been that was in the middle of the road? So we make a plan the next day because we got to go back to school because it's a school night. We're going to go up there and check first thing in the morning before school. We wake up, 6 o'clock, grab the guns, and we head up that way. I see that thing standing out there. Chris, there it is. We don't know what it is. But now curiosity's throwing me up. I have to find out. So we turn and back onto the road. We stop, and we're about 10 feet in front of it. We both look at each other, and we go up to it. It's a snowman, okay? This is where the humor comes out, why everybody was kind of joking around. I'm like, yeah, it's kind of funny. But this snowman is not anything I've ever seen before. The eyes, the reason why they were black is because they had been carved out in an oval alien shape. The shadows from my truck light had cast it directly on it so that it lit up, but the eyes were pure shadow.
Huh.
It had arms carved into the side of it, and it had feet. There's no footprints anywhere around. It's in the middle of the road, and this is where the end of the road is. It's a little dead-end circle. No tracks are out there. Nobody has been around there. It's not around anybody's house, and it's short, too. Whoever carved this thing up, I don't know what the idea was, but this is where we saw the alien ship stop. We never found anything. There was some strange footprints up there that we saw. There's no footprints around here. As crazy as it sounds, but maybe that snowman was made by them as some little weird thing. I have no idea.
Well, the lack of tracks around the snowman would be in that category of high strangeness.
That is true.
So that was Jared Beeler's firsthand experience with a round UFO and the strange alien-looking snowman that had no tracks around it in 1999 when Jared was 16 years old living in Salmon, Idaho. 6 years later, in July 2005, at age 22, Jared had entered the U.S. Army. He was stationed at Fort Richardson in Anchorage, Alaska, for infantry training with the 509th Airborne. During one winter mountaineering course, the students were told that whoever passed would be rewarded with travel to a glacier near the Black Rapids Army Training Facility. That's 120 miles northeast of Mount Denali, that used to be Mount McKinley. 60 miles east of that big mountain is supposed to be a large and ancient underground pyramid that I've reported about several times at Earth Files. Jared passed the course and, along with half a dozen others, was rewarded with travel to a glacier not far from Kastner Glacier, southeast of Black Rapids. Their instructors were a Sergeant Bareilles, who had worked in Vietnam with a CIA agent who was also now teaching in the Army mountaineering course, and another man described as Delta Force trained. Jared Beeler had promised his Army buddies that he would tell them about the UFO adventure that he had in Salmon, Idaho, and everyone is now gathered around Jared to listen.
It's July up there, so the sun has not set. Everybody's sitting around. I'm like, all right, guys, just as I promised, I will tell you the alien story. So everybody's gathered around, and Borellis is there too, Sergeant Borellis that was training us. And I told him about when I'm in Salmon, Idaho as a young man, me and my friend chased down a UFO. At the end of the story, everybody's kind of chuckling a little bit. Well, Borellis is looking at me really seriously and goes, Beeler, I got something that was right up your alley, and I think you're going to like it. And I'm like, what's that? He's like, I got something that I've seen up here, and it's pretty crazy. I think you'd like to know about this. And I'm like, okay, what's that? He goes, about a year ago, we were down the road from here on a place called Kastner Glacier, and they're pulling Akios. Those are sleds that you pull when you're in a winter environment like we train in Alaska, pulling them with snowshoes. They're on this glacier 4 days. I've looked up Kastner Glacier, and they could have been anywhere. I have no idea. But he goes, 4 days in, they're walking, pulling the Akios, and they come across a sphinx. And I'm like, whoa, stop right there. What do you mean, sphinx? It's like a cat? He's like, no, no, no. Like the one in Egypt. I'm like, what are you talking about? A sphinx in Egypt? He's like, yes. Like the sphinx in Egypt. I'm like, how big was it? He's like, looked like it, same size, maybe a little bit smaller than the one in Giza in Egypt. I'm like, that's the most amazing thing I've ever heard. You get any pictures, you get close. What happened? He goes, no. Then it got close. We all saw it, but there was military soldiers around it. What do you mean, military soldiers? No, no, no. It wasn't us. It was somebody else, and we don't know who they were, but they were heavily armed, and they had bunkers around it, fortifying the area, and it looked like they were doing some sort of research or something like that. I snapped off a couple pictures, and we kind of made a sharp left turn, and we never went back that way. I'm like, wow, that's amazing. Well, I can't stop thinking about this sphinx story. I mean, that really blew my mind. And all the guys are sitting around, they heard it, but they're not interested like I'm interested. I have to know. I need to talk to him more personally again. So when we get back to the barracks, I find him in the hallway. I'm like, hey, let's talk about that sphinx again. And I'm like, man, where was that? Can you show me on a map where this glacier is? So we go over to a local map that's on the wall. And he's like, the map's not very good, so I can give you a rough idea. But here's Kastner Glacier. And we were up here like this, and he kind of points at us with his finger, and he's like, anywhere from 20 to 40, maybe 50 miles south of Black Rapids. The Sphinx was supposed to be up Kastner Glacier 4 days, so however far that they could make it in the direction they were going, east, up Kastner Glacier. But they started on Kastner Glacier, and we still called it Kastner Glacier the whole time when they saw this Sphinx.
What did he say? It could have been in the ice, under the ice?
He just said there was Sphinx up there. It must have been on an outcropping of rock on one of the glaciers up there where it splits on the top. That's the only thing I can think of. The military group around it that wasn't Army were heavily armed. They had built bunkers around it and looked like they were protecting it, and they didn't want to get close because they thought they might get shot.
What is the year that Borellis is saying that he climbed on this glacier and saw the Sphinx?
I'm thinking it must have been 2004 or 2003, because he said it was about a year ago. Before he left, I went up before we were getting on the bus, and I said, Sergeant Borellis, man, that story is just absolutely incredible, and I know that you snapped off some pictures like you said. This is my email address. I would love if you could email them to me. That would be great. And he said that, yes, definitely, when I get back up to Fairbanks, I will. That was the last time I ever talked to Sergeant Borellis. I never heard from him. I never got any pictures.
And as we did before in the people who have done interviews with me about the alleged dark pyramid, I would like to ask if any Coast to Coast or Earth Files viewers, listeners, have any information about this alleged Sphinx on Kastner Glacier.
Amazing story.
Or the underground dark pyramid structure that is supposed to be west of Mount Denali in Alaska. And if you do have any information, you can communicate with me confidentially. I always honor that request. Please email me at earthfiles@earthfiles.com. Just think of a reporter who files news about the Earth. So it is earthfiles@earthfiles.com. George, why I think this is especially important and possible is that one of the big mysteries about Giza is the age of both of them, the Cheops Pyramid and the Limestone Sphinx. I have known John Anthony West and Robert Schock for a couple of decades at least, and I have talked with them at great length about the work that they did there, looking at the Sphinx and the water weathering, which now is, I think, quite acceptable. It's mainstream geology and Egyptology. And I know that in talking with John Anthony West, he thinks that the age of the Sphinx should be pushed back to a minimum of 14,000 years, which now is getting back to that period of mystery in which Göbekli Tepe sits with carbon dating at 12,000 years ago. And if the Sphinx were that old, who in the world made it and why? And so let's just put that on the chessboard for a moment and come back and say Cheops is as mysterious, but it's the relationship between the two. Cheops and the Sphinx are right next to each other. And when you go to the map that I prepared for my Earth Files report with Gerald Beeler, and you look at it, and you are seeing Denali on the lower left and the Sphinx area of the Kastner Glacier in the upper right, there is this crest that goes around in the Alaska Range. And as the crow flies, it's only 120 miles distance between the Kastner Glacier and Denali. And so is it possible? This is the question that is beginning to emerge. If we push timelines of constructions, which means some sort of an alien presence terraforming Earth, back, let's say, 12,000, 14,000 years, what was the reason for the big pyramid to be underground? Because remember, it was from the man who had been working for Bell Labs who worked underground said, from the base of the pyramid to the vertex, it was 750 feet tall, but it was 150 feet below the base of the Earth.
That's another great story, Linda, indeed. And we're going to come back and talk about something strange in Florida. Linda Moulton-Haugh with us. Linda, something very strange happening in Florida these days, huh?
Well, it's past, present, and future, because 20 years ago, on January 20th, 1996, at 3:30 in the afternoon, three young women were walking together across a vacant lot in Varginha, Brazil, when they saw a strange humanoid crouched down with red glowing eyes. Its most remarkable feature was the top of the head. It looked like it was divided into three sections in which there were three long ridges that rose up above the head like long rows, almost like furrows, rising up from the skull. And the two teenagers and the 22-year-old were so frightened that they took off running without stopping for nearly a mile all the way home. Well, Varginha is a busy, active city of some 120,000 people, and this very complicated case involved many eyewitness testimonies over several weeks. Residents kept reporting seeing these odd beings with the three long raised ridges on top of their heads. At least one was allegedly shot dead by a Brazilian military or state police unit. But what no one knew is that a long way north from Varginha, Brazil, in the town of Altamonte Springs, Florida, also in 1996, a retired U.S. Air Force crew chief encountered what he says was an identical head match to the Varginha beings in the Southern Hemisphere that year. But nobody knew about any of this. There were very few reports until a year or two later. And so what happened to the crew chief in Florida and what happened to the girls and many other people in Varginha, Brazil, it is amazing to me how the illustrations are so closely identical. And it would suggest then, George, that what was happening in Varginha was something that had the ability to also be in Florida in the United States in January of 1996. And we know that a craft crashed in Virginia and was retrieved by the Brazilian government, may be in U.S. hands as I speak. Well, this man has asked me to keep his identity confidential and to simply call him John Smith. He served at Altus Air Force Base, Oklahoma, in 1986 as a crew chief on the KC-135 tanker. His mechanical work on airplane engines would explain why, in a later encounter with aliens, his top question would be, "What is your method of propulsion?" But before he tells about his shocking encounter with the Virginia-type alien in his Florida bedroom, let's go back in time to 1989 when he was in Colorado Springs, Colorado, to serve his military reserve requirements at Peterson Air Force Base. That's when he saw his first large, completely silent triangular aircraft moving very slowly in the night sky, and it seemed to be camouflaging itself with a pale bluish tint like the surrounding stars. He thought it was very low to the ground, maybe only 250 feet altitude, and it was like it was skulking along as if not wanting to be observed. Its direction was going south towards Fort Carson Army Base, and as it flew low over his house, John Smith stood at a window of his house in awe, and he could clearly see three-dimensional structure of geometric shapes underneath the triangle. He told me, quote, "It really was just completely out of this world," close quote. He was even scared of what he was seeing, and he didn't want to go outside to watch. Not long after that, he and his family could not understand why electrical gadgets in their house would go on and off by themselves, and soon they would all be seeing another triangular aircraft when they went Christmas shopping in December of 1989. Here now from Florida is John Smith.
And then later on, we started having lights going off and on in the house one night, 2 weeks later, and I told her about it, and we had a microwave beeping by itself, and something's causing something electrical to go on around here, and I don't get it. So I attribute it to UFO because I've seen the movie Close Encounters, how things happen. We had Christmas lights on at the time, and they weren't even plugged in, going off and on. After we had the electrical problems that night, we went out, and we had to do Christmas shopping. And on our way back, we saw the second craft. At first, I saw it in the distance, and we were heading on Academy Boulevard south back home, and I saw what looked like a helicopter sitting still. The closer we got, at a stoplight, and I'm looking underneath this thing, and it's sitting right about 200 to 250 feet above the ground on an open lot right next to a Wendy's restaurant. And my daughter saw it, and I saw it, my wife saw it, and it just sat there motionless, no sound. It had three white lights in the corner, a red light in the middle, and a blue light in front, right on top.
Is this in Peterson Air Force Base, Colorado Springs?
Yeah, it's in Colorado Springs. We saw it right off the main road, Academy Boulevard. I asked my daughter, "Rachel, what does that look like to you?" She looked up, and she's just 8 years old, and she said, "Daddy, that looks like a big triangle." I said, "You're absolutely right. That's exactly what it is." So she was amazed by it, and my wife was totally dumbfounded. She couldn't believe it.
So when is the next experience that you have that gives you an encounter with non-humans?
Okay, shortly after that, I think it was about a month or two later, I had what I thought was a dream, but it was very vivid, like I was right there. And I was on a craft, which looked like a circular room. The people in it were hybrid looking. They looked human, but kind of alien, kind of not. I can't really describe it. Their heads were bigger. Their eyes are farther apart. Other than that, they look human. I remember one that had kind of an orangish, blondish hair. I can't really remember the eyes. My biggest question was, what was your method of propulsion?
What answer did you get about the propulsion?
Well, the propulsion is when he showed me a light. It was a pure white light. And they said, "This is our method of propulsion."
What do you understand that answer of the bright white light to be?
Oh, that's a good question. I really can't say for sure what, you know, I've thought about it. What the light represents, I have no idea. It's some pure energy or force.
Did you have any more encounters with beings?
Well, I had something very strange happen just recently. I found some pennies laid out on my master bedroom floor. It was six pennies in a triangle with three pennies behind it. I don't know how that came to be. I just know I walked in to go to bed one night, and there it was on the floor. And I've got pictures of it, too. But I just get a strong sense that something's going to happen. For some odd reason, those pennies were laid out after I had emailed you about the booms I've been hearing in Deltona. The booms I heard were from the direction of Ocala National Forest.
How far away, and your impression of what might be happening?
Well, they have a naval bombing range, supposedly, in the middle of Ocala National Forest. That's about an hour and a half away from where I live. So when I heard these booms recently, they were pretty strong, and I can't understand how something that far away could rattle the windows, especially with my neighbors outside, and they said, I don't know what that was. You know, we don't have them very often, and I just can't believe that unless it was an airburst of some type, that any type of bomb going off could reach this far away.
What time did you hear the booms?
The booms were at 10 o'clock in the morning. There was three booms between 10 a.m. and 10:18 a.m., if I remember correctly, in the email I sent you.
Yes, I'm looking at the email right now. It was March 29th, 2016, between 10 a.m. and 10:18 a.m., and that the booms caused your house to shake.
Yes, you could hear it and feel it.
The weather was clear and sunny.
Correct.
All of your neighbors heard this.
Yes.
They were outside looking to see what had happened.
Yes.
What did you do?
Well, I tried to pinpoint it after I heard the first boom while I was in the house. After the second one I heard, I was still in the house, and then I went out front. My neighbor saw me and said, I don't know what that was. I said, yeah, I don't know what it was either, and I went back inside the house. The last one went off, and I heard it in the northwest direction. That would be towards Ocala National Forest. Seems to me that if they were doing any kind of bombing, it would carry on longer and more often.
Is there anything that you have felt intuitively might be the connection between these strange booms that you heard on March 29th and the UFO ET phenomena in your life?
That triangular pattern of pennies that look like an arrow, it's telling me that, hey, this is not bombing, this is us. That's the feeling I got at when I saw that triangular craft.
When you say us, you mean whatever intelligence is in the triangular craft that has the strange blue light and makes no sound.
Right. I think they're affecting something like these booms, and they're wanting people to look or something. That's how I feel about it. My sense is that they're traveling in and out of our atmosphere, and I think it's trying to make us more aware of their presence. Do you want to hear about the one that shot me?
Yes.
Okay, this was in 96 in Altamont Springs, Florida. And I went to bed about 10 o'clock at night. And I have a bad habit of waking up all the time at night. And so I happened to wake up and look over towards the side where my wife was sleeping. And I saw this dark figure standing about 3.5-4 foot tall, standing on the side of her bed. So I couldn't believe my eyes. So I looked at it, looking over her. I see a dark figure standing in front of the plant where it hangs on the corner of the room on her side near the headboard, and I see it blocking the plant, and it's solid. I see three protrusions on its head, and I sit up in the bed staring at this thing for a good 10 seconds thinking, all right, what is this? There's nothing I've ever seen before, the way the shape of its head and everything and how small it is. So once I realize it's real, I lunge at it to grab it. I'm thinking the fight's on. I got an intruder in my house. I go to lunge at it, it shoots at me, and this ball of light hits me square in the chest. And it was a white ball of light with different colors in it, and it turned me off like a light switch.
What do you mean?
Like it knocked me out. Like it turned off all electrical power to my body. That's what it felt like.
Are you conscious? Are you still able to look out your eyes?
No, I blacked out, but I could actually feel. I was still conscious, but not aware of anything. I don't know how to describe it. I'm conscious, but wanting to try and move and do what I can, and I can't do anything. All I feel is myself falling, and it seemed like it took like an eternity to fall back down the bed. So once I finally felt like I hit the bed and hit the pillow, that's when I woke up and it was morning.
Wow. You were looking at the being with the three bumps on its head. Did this being raise any arm so that you saw some kind of technology?
No, I didn't see anything. The being might have had something already raised and prepared for me. I think it was waiting to see what I would do before it did anything. So once I tried to lunge at it, I think that's when it shot me.
Now, in the morning, what did your wife say?
Well, I woke up and I told her about it. She was very open to it, and she believed it happened to me. But what was really strange is when I got up and I had to go to the bathroom, and I found needle-like claw marks all down my side and on my leg, and there were welts, and they started to bleed when I got up.
And how much did they bleed?
Drops of blood all the way down.
Did they hurt?
No, they only hurt when they started bleeding.
How often did they bleed?
Just that one time.
So it was only in the beginning getting out of bed that these thin, pin-like scratches along both of your sides bled?
That's correct. They didn't bleed until after I went to the bathroom, and I started looking at them, and they started bleeding.
How long were these scratches on your body?
I would say at least a week. They went away. There's one thing I did do right after it happened. I did an internet search, and, you know, I'd never thought of beings looking like that. I just thought, okay, let's see what the different types of beings there are as far as aliens. And I found out that the being that I saw was actually reported in Brazil, where they were chasing them around, and the villagers or somebody in that country saw them running around. They looked exactly like what I saw.
In Varginha.
Yep. And that's not all of it either. I also had investigated and looked to see, when I looked down at the carpet, it had a spot that was bleached out with multicolors, and it had purple, red, green. It was the same size as the ball that hit me in the chest. I don't know where that bleach came from, but it's exactly where it stood.
Do you still have that carpet?
No.
Did your wife have any memory or dream that she had interacted with this being with the three bumps?
No, she told me nothing happened. She had no marks on her like I did.
Did you have any vivid dream after this that would explain what this character with the three bumps was and why it was there?
No.
But why was this being in your bedroom in Altamont, Florida in 1996, right next to your wife, and you wake up and it attacks you with a ball of light that disconnects you from being able to function, and in the morning you have these pin-thin scratches on both sides of your body?
The only thing I can attribute to anything is that there's something about me that they need to know something about, and I don't know what it is. That's my impression.
Are you a hybrid that is human and ET?
Who knows? I really can't say.
What is your impression of the being?
Really, all I can gather from this is that this phenomena that people are experiencing is true. It's for real.
He sounds legit, Linda.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And going back to 1996, while he is having this experience in Florida in January, when all of these other eyewitnesses and various things were happening, I think that most of the rest of the world did not realize that the Varginha case kept going on month by month, and that, in fact, when Bob Pratt, who used to work for the National Enquirer,
mm-hmm.
he went down and twice, and he probably has the best summary of the Varginha, what he called the Varginha ET capture case, of anything written. And one of his paragraphs, he said, "One night early in May," this is 1996, the first initial being January, "one night early in May, four men dressed in dark suits and ties knocked on the front door of," and now this is about the three young women who saw and were involved in the illustration of this being with the red glowing eyes and these ridges on their head. And these men, suits and ties, asked to come in, and the men never identified themselves. but spent more than an hour trying to persuade the girls to change their story and even implied they would be paid if they made their denials publicly on television. And over again through the decades, counterintelligence government agents are trying to keep people quiet, even to the point of paying for a lie on television.
They want them to just not say anything. Okay, up next, Conversations with Linda, an entire hour of your phone calls next. And our special guest tonight, Linda Moulton Howe, and it's called Conversations with Linda. We take your phone calls with her, and if you want to share some stories with us, you can do that too. So we'll do that when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to our final hour with Linda Moulton Howe. We call it Conversations with Linda. Linda, your works, your books and DVDs, they're still available to people, aren't they?
They're always available. The very first book goes back to 1989. It has never been out of print. It's been through many, many, many printings. And the reason why I don't distribute through Amazon.com is that there was a period of time when Amazon.com was extremely unfair to people who were dealing with them. And I decided that I would just distribute my books and documentaries and DVDs through earthfiles.com in the shop. It has worked out very well. And so for people listening, I have four books and three documentaries, and I'm going to be doing a new series of some of my best long, real X-Files that are going to be in special downloads and DVDs, and all of this is at the earthfiles.com shop. You go to earthfiles.com, and on the left there is a column, and you just click on the shop, and my books and the DVDs are always there. And the four books, An Alien Harvest, Glimpses of Other Realities, Volume 1 and 2, and Mysterious Lights and Crop Circles, are in many ways, I am referencing my own work now all the time because new information is beginning to come forward that is strengthening and reinforcing the validity of things that I have been exposed to over the last 36 years and that are in those four books. And I find it I'm awestruck by the way the focus is coming into play in 2016 on subjects in ways that just seem to resonate and echo from everything I was trying to deal with long ago in animal mutilations, human abductions, government knowledge, cover-up, crop formations, all of it. And it's so interesting that I think you and I and a bunch of us are going to be at Contact in the Desert.
Oh, yes, that's right. Don't forget, it's my birthday party, too.
Oh, yeah. Well, happy birthday then, and hopefully we'll all be able to celebrate with you together.
That'll be fun.
And it's 3 to 6 in June, the 3rd to the 6th, and what they have under my name is The Reality of Crop Formations, Non-Humans, Animal Mutilations, Military Underground, and Government Black Budget Projects. And that really is sort of a sum up of all the categories. And I know that in the lectures and the workshops that I'm doing, that I have been getting reactions from audiences that are so huge now. And I think part of it is that people in this age of being mad at the government and expressing their anger, that people really, really are beginning to stand up for their own experiences, like this man that I just had on in the fourth half hour. He still is not prepared to come forward with his real name or where he really lives, but he is telling a story that he has never told before, and look at how many ways it winds and braids into the history of 1996, and every time more people are coming forward, it is, I think it's encouraging so many other people. And then for an investigative reporter like me to be able to interface. I think Paul and Vicky say that we could have as many as 2,000, 2,500 people at contact in the desert.
Oh, they had a couple thousand last year.
Yeah, and so that is a step in the right direction, and I'm encouraging anybody at Earth Files and Coast to Coast to go to contact in the desert, because it is really one of the most energetic and substantive-packed conferences in the world, I would say, and that this is the time. This is the time to start interfacing with the fact that there are breakthroughs now happening in the RAF Bentwaters phenomena, that there are hugely, I think, important breakthroughs having to do with high strangeness in both human abductions and animal mutilations, which are beginning to shed more light. I'm working on amazing things having to do with symbols and binary code that have been occurring not just in Jim Peniston, but in many other people, and that we're beginning to see patterns of communication. And recently, talking with one of the geneticists, he's helped in RAF Bentwaters with the Peniston binary, and he's been helping me on another case. And he thinks that we are dealing with a binary code download telepathically that could be so complex that within the shading of, meaning if you have squares and ones, and some of the squares are clear and some of the squares are shaded black, and you take it all, you take the shaded, you get one code. You take the clear, you get one code. You take the clear and the shaded, you get a third code, and we're working on that right now. And he says he's not aware that there is any human system on Earth that would be embedding three communications in three different layers of binary code.
And Linda, in your entire career, what would you say if people said, you know, this Linda Moultonhow, she, what was it, crop formations? What do you think your forte would be?
Well, I got into all of this through animal mutilations, and I think I have done the most work there in terms of forensic science,
right,
and working with people. But that led strongly to the abductions, which led strongly to government policies of denial and cover-up and manipulation and intimidation. And then came the crop formations on their own in 1989. At least the world woke up to them in 1989 and 90. So that was right at the cusp of my having done all the animal mutilation work and the abduction work, and did my first book, An Alien Harvest, came out in 89, and here came crop formations. And so in that decade of the 90s, I went to England in the summers 7 or 8 times, had some of the most extraordinary experiences of my life, and I have now 3 times in England, I have personally seen the strange glowing orbs. I have seen at night on the top of Woodboro Hill. I have seen, they call them pumpkin orange lights. They're very unique in color, moving in and out of the trees on top of Woodboro Hill. I have seen a white, looking exactly like a mirror flashing, but moving up along the tops of wheat in another field. And then there is that famous time I was on in one of the red telephone booths connected to Art Bell, and we walked literally from a soggy east field for me to do coast to coast through that red telephone booth with 6 or 7 other witnesses who were with me that night. So we filled the coast to coast with all of these live action stories that we had a military, this is before 9/11, and so I was able to get a military-grade infrared scope into England that year, and this would have been 2000. And so it had been a huge thunderstorm, and there had been helicopters all over the East Field that day. We all knew that. That's why we were focused on it. We thought, what in the world are all of those helicopters, military, doing over the East Field? We've got to go there, even if there was a thunderstorm. And we found that all of the roads around that field, George, they had been flooded. In some cases, there were 2 or 3 feet of water. You couldn't take a car into some of those roads that night. So we knew all of the boundary of the East Field. We knew what we were looking at through the scope, that we could go star scope, infrared, and so forth. And to our eyes, the field was as black coal, and the sky was clouded. There were no stars. And yet when I picked up that military-grade scope that could look in infrared, and I'm looking out onto the field, suddenly, the first thing that popped in, and it popped in like it didn't fly in, it just popped in. It was bright, an oval. And the oval began to move, and I couldn't believe it. And I handed the scope to the other people with me and all of us now for the next 90 minutes. We were watching an oval light inside of this infrared popping back and forth, moving. One of the guys started yelling out over the field. You couldn't see anything with the human eye. Got to remember this. All of this bright action and motion was happening in a different frequency. But he started yelling, look, we're not afraid. We're not afraid. Come, we want to see you close. And the truth is, every single one of us saw the reaction, because we all kept passing the scope around. As people yelled, this thing went from an oval into a pattern of a perfect square that seemed to flutter and pulse in the scope, reacting to our yelling out into the field. And this went on as for over an hour, changing shape, jumping. And when it got to about 90 minutes, an hour and a half of this, well, all these people constantly seeing all of this happening, all of a sudden, I just happened to be the person who was holding the scope when it did like a transformation between the square and the oval, like saying goodbye or something. And then, bang, it just popped out. It like when people say a light switch. Well, that was one of the most extraordinary experiences. I and the others said the same thing. We were all being able to be a reality check on what everybody was watching. And there was something out in that field that was soggy wet. The roads were filled with water. And yet it was able to put on some sort of a communication performance with a group of us. And when you hear the people who are the so-called professionally paid debunkers say that there is nothing to the crop formations except Doug and Dave. It is so repellent to those of us who have had an experience like what I've just described, when Doug and Dave had only had boards and string in Somerset and a couple in Wiltshire, and they never were responsible for anything around the world. And in fact, the September of 1990 was the year that they came forward with one of the fringe video places and stood and said, we're responsible, we're responsible. And we all knew that was not true. And you know, George, what put that lie, that paid shill over the top, was the fact that news media like the New York Times carried the story on page 2 above the fold. I saw it with my own eyes. I still have it in a file somewhere. Crop formation mystery solved. Two gentlemen, I think is the way the Times put it, in Somerset. Well, it was preposterous. It meant that the New York Times had not done one single piece of independent investigation, because if they had done so, they would have known that that summer there were crop formations quite complex in 23 countries around the planet, including in rice paddies in Japan. Those photographs were astounding. and Doug and Dave and nobody in Wiltshire or Somerset were responsible for all of those crop formations in those 23 countries. And to this day, I'm very interested in this year of 2016, as complicated as the world is, as dangerous as and precarious feeling as it does now, and with people in the abduction syndrome saying, Linda, something's happening. Something big is going to open up. What will come down in crop formations, not just England, but last year, I think the most extraordinary crop formation perhaps of all time, except for Windmill Hill of the multiple arms back in 1996. It was Italy. It was near Turin, the Shroud of Turin, you've heard.
Mm-hmm.
This was a pattern so complicated that I have had dialogues through email and letters with people who have been trying to crack the binary code that they know is in this amazing pattern. And is there a reason why in the summer of 2015 that this huge, gigantic, complex, it is so detailed and complex, no human could even have begun to make it in its intricacy. But when people are studying it in terms of binary code, we already have gotten some of the binary code and its warning, just like all the other warnings over the last three decades that have come when we've had binary code. And there is this sense, why was it near the town where the shroud of Jesus Christ is the burial shroud, or alleged burial shroud, hangs in the Cathedral of Turin?
That story all by itself is one of the best ever, ever.
Absolutely. And there was a series that I did at Earth Files and on Coast to Coast long ago, back around 1995. And that was an interview that I did with he was a chemist, and he had done a presentation at an electrical engineering meeting in, I think it was in Missouri. And his hypothesis in the paper that he presented, which is why I interviewed him and had him on Coast, was that he wanted to duplicate the oil, the linen, everything to a T that they knew that was on the Shroud of Turin, and he put it over a low-energy X-ray. And George, when they took that linen and they took it off the low-energy X-ray, the fibrils in the upper 100th of an inch of that linen matched exactly where the discoloration is on the real Shroud of Turin in the cathedral, which is where the big crop formation was this past summer.
Yeah. Did you ever interview Barry Schwartz, who was the official photographer? He's a believer that it's authentic. That is an amazing story.
Well, yeah, and for some reason, I don't know what's happening now with your audio, but you're coming up for two words and then it's fading out.
Huh.
I don't know. It's like a wave. Oh. Now I can hear you back again. But you're asking me about Barry Schwartz. And I know that there are people who worked in the remember there was a JPL investigation?
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, hold on, Linda. We'll talk about this and we'll take all the calls from people who are lining up right here on Coast to Coast AM. Don't forget to like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. We sent out a couple more tweets tonight. I hope you got them. If you didn't, sign up and go get them again. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Linda Moulton Howe with us, and we're going to get to all your questions when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Don't forget our Friday night show, of course. We're going to dabble with the paranormal and those special open lines. Okay, welcome back to Coast. Linda's with us and your calls, and let's hit them right away. Oh, Linda, let's wrap up about the shroud real quickly,
yeah,
and then we'll go to the folks that are on hold.
This was such extraordinary work because it was presented in a formal paper at a formal conference, and in the interview, he was going through the fact that he was convinced that it was X-ray radiation or some frequency in that realm that would have gone and excited the body that was underneath the shroud. And then you jump over to the issue of some people in the government saying that they have knowledge about how this played out and that there was some sort of a beam and all of that. But even if you don't go there, it's the idea of something extraordinary at a frequency, a high frequency like an X-ray, that would have excited the X-ray would have excited the material and left that tiny residue of the brownness that makes the pattern. It's only in the 1/100th of the fibril of the linen, and that was always something very extraordinary when JPL and others had examined it, and they realized this was not something like a quote-unquote stain down woven into the fabric. This is a coloration change that is only in the 1/100th of an inch fibril on the top, and it was the X-ray that did that, and that is what he reported. And then the question was, what would generate an X-ray high frequency inside of a cave of a man who had died, and then he disappeared?
Yeah. All right, to the phones now we go. Gordon in Lakeland, Florida, to get us started. Go ahead, Gordon.
Hey, thank you for taking my call, George and Linda.
You're welcome.
First off, the green stain or mark on the carpet, I want to find out if you know if that man ever got it tested, or if not, why. And secondly, thank you for standing up for the environment. I appreciate that, but I have some concerns. I studied the CO2 phenomenon, and the CO2 levels went up and down a long time before even technology got, and we think, there, scientists are disagreeing, we think that the CO2 levels didn't cause the temperature, but rather the temperature caused the CO2 levels, although there, I will admit, there's some disagreement on that, and I wanted your take on both of those issues, if you could.
I'll start with CO2. The big anomaly right now from the 20th to the 21st century is the rapidity. In the past, when people say, well, the dinosaurs lived and it was 1,000 parts per million, that may be true. But when you go back into the record on this planet, whether they're doing it with ice or tree cores or whatever it is, everything had gradual buildups and coming down. And what we have managed to do as an industrial civilization just since the 20th century is that we have accelerated the rise of carbon dioxide and methane that could have taken, let's say, much longer over centuries, and everything would have adapted to it over a long period of time. But the warming is happening rapidly because the volume is happening rapidly, and the warming is happening at such a rate, as you can almost read in any subject now, the problems with marine life surviving, birds surviving, so many things are just having one heck of a time. Because what once upon a time were predictable and dependable seasons, and that meant that certain things would grow in one geographic place and animals would always come back there for their food. And now that's changing all over the planet. It's changing rapidly. It's changing more rapidly than plants can keep up and lots of earth life. And that is the key to this whole question of what is happening and why is it so serious. It's the rapidity. Now, on the issue on the stain on the floor, I asked him and had hoped that he still had the carpet, because, boy, would I have liked to get that into a lab. But his answer was no, and they never did test it. And I have found this. I know it seems upside down and backwards, but I think it is part of the human psyche. When things occur that are outside of, way far outside of what is considered to be a normal paradigm. People are so bothered, they don't want it around. They want everything that happened in a room, anything that's associated with spills or anything, they want it out. And in some ways, I really understand and I have sympathy, but if there are people listening who may end up having interactions with beings or they have something strange happen, please get in touch with me. It is through physical examinations in labs where I've had my strongest evidence in the crop formations and animal mutilations. Those are two areas where we have a lot of forensic science. And it always helps, even though I am convinced there is an alien presence. The bigger question now is, where did the alien presence, did it come from? Has it always been here? Is it always underneath the Earth? And what exactly is the relationship between the alien presence and the surface life? And we humans are a surface life on this planet. And it is part of this century, I think, that we are redefining everything that the human family is in relationship to the planet, to the cosmos, and to something that seems to have a big grasp on what we are and always is keeping itself in the shadows and invisible while we are tested, monitored, and manipulated. I think that when John Keel wrote that book, The Haunted Planet, it was Our Haunted Planet, that was the title. I think that was one of the best titles of all time. Our Haunted Planet. It is haunted because we are a surface life that has evolved in the presence of something else that never seems to want us to be able to have a direct relationship with it.
Next up, Gina in Brooklyn, New York. Hi, Gina. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. Good morning, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure, you're very welcome.
My topic is reincarnation,
uh-huh.
And your comments before that, Rudolf Steiner saying that we're all volunteers, but we don't remember. Well, I do. And I also wanted to say something about David Bowie, but first, let's talk about me. I do remember, I have a very strong conscious, even visual memory of the conversation of being asked to come back. It was like a misty white, and there was like a grandfatherly figure and his assistant, and they asked me. They said, you know, we'd like you to come back. It's your choice, and we want to show you what, you can expect, to happen. And I just immediately said, no, you don't speak further. I will go. If it's important enough for you to ask me to go, I will go. And they said, well, wait, but you still have to look. We still want to show you this. And I don't remember what they showed me, but in the first couple of years of my life, I have a very, very strong memory of, I guess you would say, astral traveling back and forth to visit.
Well, look, there's no question that, in my mind, Linda, reincarnation is the real deal.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and to follow up, thank you to the...
We won't have time for your David Bowie question because we've got too many callers and not enough time. So
Linda. Just going to say that one of the most important reinforcements of reincarnation came to me through a man who was dying. He had been the Air Force captain who had spent time at Los Alamos with one of the beings that they had retrieved. And they could, the captain could understand the telepathic downloads of the extraterrestrial biological entity, and others could not. And one of his statements before he died was, in answer to a question, is reincarnation real? He answered in the context of what the Eben had told him. Yes, reincarnation, the recycling of souls, is the machinery of this universe. And I do think it is the fundamental key, and that we shouldn't be so Kardashianized and focused on bodies and matter. We should be concentrating on developing and evolving that part of us that is the pura vida, and that is that life force that animates the body. At death, that's what leaves.
Jerry's in Santa Fe, Texas now. Hi, Jerry. It's your turn.
Well, hello, George. Great show you have.
Thank
I'm
you,
a first-time
sir.
Caller. I really, really enjoy listening to you.
Good to have you.
My reason why I'm calling is I'm familiar with the Kastner Glacier area. I've hiked it. And the guy that was telling the story about the Black Sphinx, or hearing the story about the Black Sphinx, did you ever try to interview any bush pilots that may have been flying around the area? You know, that time of year, there's always, it seems like, always but a plane in the air. Every hour, every other hour, you're hearing them. And it seems to me like, you know, that would be something that would be seen, obviously, by a pilot up there. And I was just wondering if there had been any reports, maybe, of the Black Sphinx, other than...
Well, the Sphinx is not, we haven't put a color on that. The dark, the word dark,
dark, okay.
Went to the Dark Pyramid. The stories that I was reporting with whistleblowers in 2012, what is so interesting is that within 120 miles as the crow flies on the ridge of that Alaska range, that we would have a series of people talking about a dark pyramid. That is a word that was used for a reason having to do with it being deep underground. And that was in front of Mount Denali, going to the west 60 miles. And now here comes Jared Beeler with his story from the Sergeant Borealis of a sphinx. We don't know characteristics beyond, he said, that it was similar in size. Get this. Similar in size to the Sphinx in Giza. And the question of where could it be, and that there was some sort of a military unit that had surrounded it for some period of time, and this was back, he thought, in 2004, 2003. The glaciers up there, as you know, if you go to my Earth Files report, and you look at the glaciers, and I've been also looking at Google Earth, that you will find that up on some of those ridges, it's absolutely snowless. And the Sphinx, according to Jared, at the time that they were looking at it, was not, he didn't think was in snow, but that it had been, or it had been covered because it had just emerged. So your suggestion is part of the reason I so much wanted to do this story tonight on Coast, whether it's pilots, military, intel, anybody out there who may have the way to look over the Kastner Glacier or who has had experiences there and could let me know. We would sure, Jared Beeler and others and I would sure like to be able to follow up. I can say I talked with another one of the men in his group and completely confirmed the discussion, being there, hearing about the Sphinx, and how nobody could believe that a Sphinx like Giza could be up somewhere in 4 days from Black Rapids up on Kastner Glacier. It's incredible, but the idea that a Sphinx and a pyramid would be together on this planet, if in fact the planet has been terraformed by an alien presence that knows what it's doing with something that we don't have a clue, that's what intrigues me about the juxtaposition of these two up there in Alaska.
What great stories on this planet, Linda. Just great stories.
Yeah, well, it's an amazing, amazing universe, an amazing planet, and I can't think of anything that I would rather do than keep exploring the mysteries and trying to report the facts.
Sean is in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Hey, Sean, good morning to you.
Hey, George, Linda, thank you all for taking the call. I'll try to be as efficient with this as I can.
Okay.
When I was in eighth grade, 1988, a friend and I, we snuck out on his motorcycle. This was in Gwinnett County, Georgia, and we went down Five Forks Trickum Road. right where Ronald Reagan Parkway is now. Before that was there, his girlfriend had a house there. It was a long dirt road to an old cabin. They had a note to say, you got to move out in 5 years. We're wrecking it to build this road. So he goes up there to see her, and I'm sitting at the end of this driveway in the woods, probably 30 or 40 feet off the two-lane blacktop road, just sitting on his motorcycle, and I hear this. It's three in the morning. I hear this oscillating sound, just this oscillating, just all in the air, all around. And I stand up, and I'm looking up in the trees towards it, and it's just woo 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 woo, just oscillating like you couldn't believe. And sometime later, I'm probably 150, 100 feet over, face down on my knees and hands, and I feel like I'm in a net of some sort, but. You know, I'm on the ground in the leaves, and
so there was like missing time. There was missing time between the sound and you discovering yourself on the ground in leaves.
Probably most of the time. We've got a minute left here.
Yeah, can you email me at earthfiles@earthfiles.com so that I can talk with you about this story more in depth?
I would love to. I'll absolutely do that.
Super,
oh,
super.
Do.
Linda, as we wrap things up, where do you go next? I guess I'll see you in Joshua Tree.
Well, yes, and before that, I'm going to be up in Dulce at the conference there. There's going to be a very interesting group of us about the strange history of North, that part of New Mexico in relationship to are there or is there evidence of an underground alien presence in Dulce, in Area 51, in Rachel, in the Himalayas, around the world?
Something could be happening there indeed. Hey, Linda, thanks again. We'll see you also next month for another series of great reports. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Borelson, George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.